Access number 16718. Major Wilfred White, Reel 3.
Mr. White, Reel 3. You, of course, as you've said, didn't get into uniform straight away. So when you'd finished your degree, what happened to you then?
I applied again to, you know, join up. And eventually, a matter of days, I think, somebody accepted that. Dan, let's waste time with his blood. Let's get him off the war and, you know, let's have a bit of peace. Now, who that organization was or where it took place, I don't know. But I spoke to my professor and said, now, look, I've become qualified, but I'm also a partially trained soldier. I have my certificate A and B, you know, which is... it's really not a lot, but it accustoms you to walking about and looking smart and knowing how to use a rifle and that sort of thing. I said, I must get in. I said, all my friends are going in.
But you spent some time prior to getting in working, hadn't you?
Ah, yes. Yes, but this, I'm talking about the stage where, having got my degree, instead of going straight on into the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries, I was laying down my lines of, because I could now walk away from the university, you know, if it came to a push. I can't remember the unit that said, right, we'll do this and this and you're going to be a soldier. But somewhere along the line that happened, and I've got a feeling it was through my professor, who was my contact, you see. And eventually I got a formal, you know, buff saying that they thanked me for the da-da-da. But until a suitable time, would do this job in Cumberland. And what it was, I was assistant scientific officer appointed. The salary of something incredible, like £4 a week, on the wireworm survey. Now, what is this? Well, the wireworm is that little piece of insect grub. Looks like a bit of copper, a little bit of copper wire in there, but it wriggles about, and it's a voracious eater of potatoes, for example, and the state of the economy was such that the farmers were having to dig over every bit of land they could lay their hands on, and a lot of that land was what they term old pasture land. It had been lying fallow from the year dot. Nothing had ever, other than the grass, which they used for grazing. Nothing ever came from it, but the farmers were now ploughing it all up, and I think potatoes go in first in their certain sense to clean the ground, you know. Well, what they were finding is these little larvae, the wireworms, the larvae of the click beetle, they'd been lying waiting for this, and they really were having a birthday, and they were massacring the tropics. So I joined a squad, must have been squads all over the country, obviously, of being involved in getting the best out. And briefly what it was, we did a field survey. The farmers had to, you know, had to allow us to do this. We went and we sampled the field. We had a digger which took a known quantity of soil, and we had some girls busy breaking the soil up and pulling out the wireworms and counting them and plotting them on a piece of paper, and we eventually ended up with a map of the field, of course drawn to scale by this time, and all our findings showed a distribution of these little pests. And so we could in the sort of minimum of time, we could go to the farmer and say, now there's the field, and then explain it all to him, and you could see the concentration where these, there's a big concentration there, but that was all right, that wasn't bad, but you could plant that field, and what could we do with this one? Well, the only thing we had there was more cultivation, so let the birds get at them. And it was round about this time that we found that naphtha was an insecticide. So we treated that heavily. Not worth putting potatoes in that this year. But do what you can to get these down. And from that rough sort of start, you know, gradually, the way things go, once they're under control and you know what the problem is, insecticides got better, or pesticides, whatever you call them. And that was a battle, and I had 8 weeks of that. And came the morning, I was in digs in Cumberland at Penrith, the headquarters, and my then boss, Sandy, he bought a car, because he was South Shields lad, but he didn't like driving up the banks. You know, it's quite hilly going to the Lake District. So he said, would you drive? I said, oh, golly, I would. Mind, there's no testing, and I hadn't driven before. But there was no, you know, there wasn't any necessity. There wasn't much traffic. And I used to drive over in this fluid flywheel car, very old-fashioned, you know, by that standards. We got there. And the morning I got my call-up papers, you will report too, you see. I was so excited. Oh, it didn't have gears. It had what they called a fluid flywheel. I can't quite remember how it works, but I think the gear change, as we know it, was on the steering wheel, and of course didn't quite put it into reverse when it should have been forward drive. And I went through the back of the garage. It was a wooden garage, and I went straight through it. And I thought, you bloody fool. Anyway, off I went and did my duty for the day. And my last call was on the banks overlooking this lake. I think it was Ellswater Farm, and there was a colonel, an ex-army man, who had it, and I checked his field over once before, and he had automatic gates, so that as you drove off the road, the gate swung open and then closed immediately behind you, and there was two of these before I swung round the back of his house, you see, into the yard, and there's this gorgeous wooden structure. And I realized too late that it wasn't on an automatic opening device. And there's a creaking of wood splintering, and I thought, you've done it now. I'll eventually pay for the back of a garage, but I can't take this on. So anyway, I went in and saw him. And we did our business. He's a nice chap. Have a sherry, you know. So does I have a drink? And I said, well, before I have a drink, I've got something else to tell you, sir. I said, I was so excited at getting my calling up. He said, good boy. Papers. That I bumped your gate. He said, not the one outside at the back. I said, I'm afraid so, sir. He said, you bloody fool. And he sent for his man and said, well, go and this blight has bashed our gate. Go and check it for me. And the poor man had a one of these palates that, you know, something wrong with the palate, did not. Certainly couldn't hear what he said when he came back. But he says, you're lucky. You're very lucky. He says, have another sherry. He says, he can fix it. And he says, and enjoy your soldiering. And off I returned home, weekend. That was the end of that. My life as a zoologist.
How did your mother take the actual news that you were now going in the forces?
For the day, badly. I think probably like most other mothers, really. But my mother tended to show her feelings. And I was always concerned about Mum, because I now understand what it's like being a parent. You know, I get hot pants when I know they're going flying out to ski somewhere. There was never any question of you should have stopped with your zoology or this. You just did what all good mothers do, sent the office clean, and I can't remember quite what we had to take with us.
What was your father's response?
Oh, well, Dad was all right, you know. I never knew really what he was thinking. The only time when he could physically help by giving us the odd bob or two, you know, to cover whatever it was, a pair of new rugby boots or going out with them. Now, Dad was, he often used to tell me little stories of what had happened to when he was out in France during the First World War, that he obviously hadn't been in the trenches. There was no sort of blood and guts sort of get yourself out there and kill a few for me sort of things, that totally uneventful. I was just another lad going off to join the army. Lucky bugger, I hadn't been in from the start, you know, if there was any comment, because most of the lads, the younger lads that I knew, were into the DLI, for instance, you know. And
what date was it when you joined up?
Well, we'll have to work this out a little bit now. I graduated in 1941 in the summer, and chased my professor and asked him to get cracking so that I could get into the services. As I've mentioned, I had to do some service for the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries while this was being sorted out, which lasted about 2 months. And then I went virtually straight into OCTU at Heysham near Morecambe, an infantry officer's real thing. And that would be 1941, just before Christmas, say October, November of 1941.
The war, of course, had been on for some time then, and we'd come through Dunkirk.
Yes.
What was the attitude and morale of people around you? Because it was one disaster after another.
Yes. Well, we were either, stupid, but no one seemed to worry too much. We always feel them when push came to shove. We would handle the situation. You see, they had to invade us, we said. And we were already being bombed right, left and centre by the Air Force. And this population, although there were a lot of fearful casualties. They were really taking it, not enjoying it, but there was no sign of morale crumpling, you know. And like many people that I met later, there was the thought of not winning. I know it just sounds a bit stupid, but the thought of that, not winning, but not losing, I beg your pardon, it never seemed to cross their mind. You know, they're doing a job to the best of their ability. And yes, when you had a few pints, perhaps, you said, if we made another Bosch, more cruder of that one. And when, for example, one of the aircraft carriers was sunk, would it be the Ark Royal, and with the fearful casualties, some of whom were local boys, you know. We fell down at the mouth, but the question of the seriousness of the end of the war never really came into my or our reckoning.
Did you find in those months during the war at this stage, and you were in civilians and a young man and a healthy looking young man, any kind of remarks or attitudes against you because you weren't in uniform?
Not directly to my face. Mind you, I was virtually cheating in that every day to travel up to Newcastle and back again, I was in uniform. Because of, you know, I was almost on a permanent 3 or 4 hours every night, or afternoons, or whatever, training or being trained. So that I don't doubt that things were said which I didn't pick up. That really didn't cross my mind, you see. And that's why I think I probably got a light ride for it.
When you joined the officers' training unit, what kind of reception did you get on arriving there?
At Heysham? There was no red carpet. It wasn't. We didn't get on that. We formed one platoon of a company, while the other two platoons of the company had been, you know, from the ranks, senior NCOs, and one or two sort of young corporals and that sort of thing, sergeant majors, but they're all experienced men. We were a set of university graduates to a man. A lot of fine blokes. We really had to have the edges knocked off as quickly as possible, and the establishment was designed to do that, and we weren't giving the lickings of a dog. It was my first taste of army discipline, which whichever way you approach it was a bit tough, especially in the winter of that year, and we were in a sort of a bathing chalet sort of held four people, two double bunks, and my God, it was cold.
You've mentioned the accommodation there. Were these small huts or large platoon company size things?
No, they were small huts, small individual huts, which platoons were grouped in them, about four to a hut, in alphabetical order. I remember I had the Williams. Sorry. But anyway, we were in alphabetical order. I had a lower bunk. There was no sort of cabinets or drawers to keep in your inevitable necessities. A kid bag, of course. and a bit short on the blankets, but you got short shift if you asked for another blanket. It was very, very Spartan, is the only word, and we realized very quickly that it had to be so, because we'd come from civvies, a privilege that not many had. We'd been cushioned for 2 or 3 years, and we really had to get woken up a bit. And the words were, "I'll do it in a few minutes, Sergeant Major," or whatever, didn't exist. And the NCO staff there were sort of brigadier guardsmen, the regimental sergeant major. I never saw him smile. And the company sergeant major, he was the right man for the job. He really gave us no peace. And I remember one occasion which caused a bit of a stir. Was a Cambridge undergraduate. Unfortunately, he had red hair and pale blue eyes. He was very, very posh. Said to the OC, the company commander, "I thought this sergeant major sort of had to do so and so at such and such a time every day. You told us that." He said, "Well, he's not doing it." And of course, I don't know what the company commander said to the sergeant major, but I know what happened to us. The whole platoon, he went round and every one of us was on a charge for some reason or another. I remember my spare boots weren't clean enough when he came into our hut, so I got a week's jankers for that. And that was hell. That every time they blew a bugle, a certain call, I had to run and get into my best, put my fighting equipment on, you know, and fall in defaulters parade. It was agonizing.
Was it a common philosophy that if one man in the unit let you down or did something, the whole lot suffered?
Yes, indeed. No questions asked. Those the individual ones. You know, I can't think of an example. There wasn't much of that sort of thing. It was just this one mass punishment that sticks in my memory. But the army won, you know. They always do. I remember the day we got our jabs, inoculations. My arm had swollen up, and there was two sort of hook and eye on the top of your tunic that you had to fasten. And I struggled, you know, for hours, getting later and later for breakfast, and I managed to get one of the hooks fastened. And of course the orderly officer was standing at the entrance to the dining hall, the mess, and I went galloping in. He says, "You're improperly dressed, get out, fix your dress." And I started to say, "Well, look, I've got a bad eye." "Get out and get properly dressed," you know, that sort of thing. But it was, that's been good for us, you know.
Coming from a university background, as you say, your particular unit did, initially in the beginning, was a lot of questioning about the army and the strict regulation and the no answer back thing?
No, I honestly think that the bulk of them were there at OCTU because they wanted to be in the forces. I do honestly believe that. The only thing is we didn't know how to carry it, you know, behave, really, with the military mind or the military background. There'd been no gradual build into this. We're just virtually plucked out. Fortunately, I'd had a bit of contact with my OTC at the university. But, you know, the only thing was when we did something stupid and so unmilitarily that the really, although they kicked you up the backside, they really patted you on the back and had a good laugh, said, "Now, for God's sake," like, I might not remember this, but correctly, but when we were turned out in our full equipment, battle order, or whatever it's called, the gas cape was rolled up, and on the top of your pack with a cord, so when you pulled it down, it came. And just went on and went on. And this morning, the Sergeant Major, the Sergeant Major's parade, warrant the boss, and he said, you know, whatever the command was, gas or something. So he had to pull it down. And the bloke in front of me, he'd got mixed up, and he had, in fact, packed his gas cape inside his pack, and on the top he had his ground sheet. In some way, he'd rolled it up, in some way, don't know what was. But when he pulled his string, down came his ground sheet, you see. Well, that caused a stir, and that was the first time I think I saw the regimental sergeant major. He had a grin on his face. Get it fixed. But occasionally we made a big faux pas because of ignorance, you know, and not knowing the spirit of the thing yet.
But coming back to the accommodation, you would have to keep your own area clean.
Oh yes, oh yes.
And was that inspected regularly?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Every day, and your name appeared if it wasn't good enough. But it always was good enough until they. Certainly, our hat was until we fell foul of this idiot who challenged the Sergeant Major, you know, where were you, sort of thing. But as you say, to have dust on your spare boots, you know, when you're out flogging your guts out. And it sort of coincided with, I think whether it was Montgomery's early days, but he was influencing the army, that the training is not tough enough. You know, that there was a period when everything had to be done, you know, to show how fit you were. I mean, even colonels of 50 or whatever had to go out for the physical marches and the runs. Must have written quite a few off. But
how was your accommodation heated?
It wasn't. It wasn't that I can remember. Very badly is the answer to that. Because I slept in more than my pajamas. I left things on and put my great coat in the still of night. My great coat went on top of the one or two blankets, things like that. Because again, the winter was tough. And, oh man.
Ablutions, where were they in relation to your huts?
We had to walk, not a long way, a quick dash where there's the regimental basins and the regimental loos and showers, all in the one sort of block. It was quite competent, but. It wasn't very attractive, but it, you know, functional, totally functional. And one of the few things that I hated about army life was the fact that the bathroom was always wet. You know, what passed as the bathroom, the floor was always a swill with water. And I remembered. My bathroom will have a carpet when I get back, you know, the sort of things.
And did you have hot water laid on?
Oh, yes, there was hot water. I can't remember anything particularly, other than the sloppy water all over the place. And
were they basins or were these metal basins?
they were a fixture of a basin with a whatever it was, a wood surround. And I can't remember anything more clearly than that, whether it was metal under, as you say. But
what was the toilet situation? Was it basic as well?
Adequate. Fortunately, it was reasonable. You know, the people did what they ought to do, and there was no sort of fouling up the place. That was all right.
And were they flush toilets? Did they flush away?
Yes, I flushed away.